Chapter 3 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 3. I went to a private school called Lambrook when I was 10. My brother Drumlanrig, we called him Francie, who was 4 years older than me, being then in his last term at the same school before going to Harrow. Percy, being destined for the Navy, went to a school at Portsmouth in preparation for the Britannia. Lambrook was a very classy school in the sense that it was chiefly populated by sprigs of nobility. Two of Queen Victoria's grandsons, Prince Victor and Prince Albert of Schleswig-Holstein, were there, and on more than one occasion the Queen came over from Windsor to see them and spend an hour or two in our cricket field. But after I'd been there about a year, a row took place, the causes of which I did not fathom till many years later, and the school more or less broke up. I was moved to another school called Wixenford, kept by a Mr. Arnold, and my younger brother, Sholto, went with me. My recollections of Wixenford are nothing like so pleasant as those I have of Lambrook, and to this day I feel sore over the fact that I was, as I considered, done out of the prize for classics, Latin and Greek, which I certainly earned by plurality of marks, but which was diverted from me to Leveson, now Lord Granville. Not that I had any but the most friendly feelings towards him. His mother, Lady Granville, and my mother were great friends, and I can just remember the celebrated Lord Granville, his father, and a week's visit I paid to Wolmer Castle with my mother. Leveson was famed in those days as the boy who swallowed half a crown. He performed this feat accidentally while giving a conjuring performance to a circle of young friends, and the most dire apprehensions were felt about him for several days. However, he never was any the worse. He was a flaxen-haired and waxen-faced child, and looked like a nice doll. We were great friends in those days, but my chief friend at Wixenford was a boy called Shepherd. He was an American, and he fascinated me by, among other things, his way of talking. He used to call me Puppy Dog, and Mr. Arnold, who was of a sarcastic turn of speech, and fond of exercising his tongue on his pupils, discovering this by chance, said one day, "What sort of puppy dog? An Italian greyhound, I should think." After that, whenever he wanted to annoy me, which was fairly often, he called me the Italian greyhound. This used to fill me with rage and grief, and often reduced me to tears. Why I should have objected so much to being called an Italian greyhound by my schoolmaster, while I gloried in being called puppy dog by the friend of my heart, is one of the lost mysteries of childhood which I cannot recapture. Mr. Arnold, though by no means an unkind man, was to my childish eyes very alarming. He was very tall, with a black beard, and closely resembled the picture of Agrippa in Struwelpeter. And it appeared to me that he had a special down on me, though I must add that there was no such thing as ill-treatment at this school, and the cane was practically unknown. I remember only two boys being licked with a birch rod all the time I was there. What they were supposed to have done I never could find out, but it must have been considered very serious. Mr. Arnold's attacks on me were purely verbal, but I suffered agonies from them, being very sensitive, and also, alas that I must say it, frightfully spoilt at home by my mother. I was a very pretty child, and had captivating ways, and my mother could not, or did not, resist me. The consequence was, of course, that I suffered proportionately more at school. It is a recollection of this fact, and kindred consequences, that always makes me gnash my teeth when I see a spoilt child. I would rather see a child badly treated than spoilt. Experience shows that suffering is good for the soul, a theme which I have elaborated in my poem In Excelsis, which I wrote in prison as the result of the worst possible suffering, namely, the suffering that comes from the sense of injustice and the ingratitude of those for whom one has sacrificed oneself. What was lacking in my home was a father. My mother's spoiling would not have harmed me if my father had been a real father, and had ever taken half as much interest in his children as he did in his dogs and his horses. As it was, I scarcely ever saw him, and when, for the first time in his life, he suddenly tried to exert his authority over me in a very violent way, I am referring to the occasion when he suddenly ordered me to give up my friendship with Oscar Wilde, I defied him, and he ruthlessly and deliberately ruined my life. All through my childhood and youth, the shadow of my father lay over me, for though I loved him, and had indeed a quite absurd admiration for his supposed heroic qualities, I could not be blind to his infamous treatment of my mother, even long before she was driven to divorce him, which took place when I was 16. I must here explain that though my mother divorced my father, she never remarried, or had the slightest intention of doing so. I mention this because she is now a Catholic, and it is a matter of common knowledge that the Catholic Church does not recognise divorce, or really, to put it more accurately, does not allow the remarriage of either party to a divorce. My father, on the other hand, did marry again, and his marriage was annulled within 6 months of its celebration. When I left Wixenford, I went to Winchester, being then just under 14. I wanted to go to Eton, chiefly because my beloved shepherd had gone there, and my mother and I had quite settled that I was to go there. But my father stopped at the last moment, and said he would not have any of his sons turned into Belgravian loafers, which was his quaint expression for what he imagined to be the typical and representative results of education at that celebrated school. My father was like that. He knew nothing whatever about Eton, or any public school, having been on the Britannia and in the Navy himself, but his prejudices, once formed, were as utterly insurmountable as they were often unreasonable. Winchester was in a transitional stage at that time. Just before I got there, it was still a very savage place. I came in for the last year of the real savagery, which, really and truly, was very much like that of Tom Brown's school days. There was a boy in our house who might have sat for a model of Flashman. I remember thinking that my parents must be quite mad to send me to such an awful place. I don't like abusing my old school, for which I still have a great affection, but, truth to tell, it was a sink of iniquity. My first 18 months there were pretty much of a nightmare. After that I got used to the conditions, adapted myself to the standard of morality, or rather immorality, and enjoyed the whole thing tremendously. I went up there a sensitive, dreamy child, passionately pure and devoted in my heart to every noble ideal. I had been brought up by my mother to love purity, truth and beauty. I had a natural taste for the best in everything. At 8 years old I preferred Romeo and Juliet and Henry IV to any book of fairy tales, not excepting the still beloved Hans Andersen. I loved music, and I had been accustomed all my life to be in houses where my eyes rested on beautiful pictures, glorious tapestries, and the harmony of everything that is connoted by perfect taste. I left Winchester neither better nor worse than my contemporaries, that is to say, a finished young blackguard, ripe for any kind of wickedness. Of course, I don't mean that I, any more than my school friends, had lost all that we had learned, some of us, at home. But we had superadded to it all that our much vaunted English public schools can teach. I suppose this sort of truth-telling only makes English people angry, so I will say no more. If anyone wants to know what I think about Protestant public schools, I refer him to the remarks on the subject of W.G. Ward, Ideal Ward, see W.G. Ward and the Oxford Movement by his son, the late Wilfred Ward. Ideal Ward was at Winchester too, and he spoke, as I do, from actual experience. By the time my son Raymond was 9 years old, I had made up my mind that I would rather see him dead than at a Protestant public school, and, though it involved a strenuous fight with my father-in-law, Colonel Custance, I kept him from sharing the fate of his father. He went to a Catholic school, with the result that at 25 years of age he is as innocent, in the true sense of the word, as I was when I first went to Winchester. My greatest friend at Winchester was Encombe, with whom I afterwards shared rooms at Oxford. Like nearly all the few faithful friends who went on sticking to me after I got into trouble with society, he is dead. Providence has never allowed me to keep a powerful, in the worldly sense, friend. If Encombe had lived, things would have been very different for me, and the same applies to my cousin, George Wyndham, who became my friend only in the last few months of his life after completely misjudging and misunderstanding me for 20 years before. It shows the sort of man George Wyndham was that we never really became friends till after I had been smashed in the ransom trial case, which I lost, as I shall explain more in detail later on. Just because I was in the world's eyes down and out, he rushed in to help me, although he didn't really even like me at that time. Once being my friend, he would never have left me in the lurch, as so many others did, including many of his and my own family, who had not the excuse of being able to say that they had never cared about me. I have often felt inclined to put the English down as the most cowardly and disloyal people in the world. I have some excuse for thinking so, for English friend after English friend has betrayed me and deserted me and played me false after getting all he could out of me. But when I get to that stage of bitterness, inevitable from time to time, the memory of Encombe and George Wyndham crops up, and for their sake I qualify all I have said about the English. I have a stack of George Wyndham's letters in my possession. I offered them to those who were compiling a collection of his letters, but they did not appear to want them. It is rather amusing, because in 100 or even 50 years they will be worth more than all his other letters put together, just because they were written to me. If anyone says that this is rank egoism, I reply that a man of my age is entitled to tell what he believes to be the truth about himself in his own autobiography. In fact, he is not only entitled to tell the truth, but he is bound to do so. I cannot leave these recollections of my childhood and boyhood without a word about my great-uncle, the Honourable Percy Wyndham, George's father, and his wife, my great-aunt Madeline Wyndham. During all that period, Uncle Percy and Aunt Madeline took a place in my affections which enshrines them forever in my grateful memory. So many people have written about Aunt Madeline and the magic of her personality, her charm, her charity, her kindness, her genius, that I can add nothing to what has already been written. Uncle Percy, in his own way, was just as entirely delightful. Though generally supposed to be rather formidable, he was, I believe, the softest-hearted and most amiable man in the world. He was also a man of great intellectual acumen and brain power, and had an unfailing eye for shams and humbug. He was very modest and rather shy, and when at clouds his feelings became too much for him, in the face of any kind of manifestation of modern tomfoolery or heresy, he generally, like the young lady of Sweden, made no observation, but retired to his study and shut the door. He was full of wisdom, and had the perfect taste which always admires the best, and is not taken in by mere passing vogues. I am more proud of the fact that he loved the Academy when I was editing it, and told me in a letter that it represented all sorts of, to me, cherished ideals which I had thought had disappeared forever from modern life, than I am of any other circumstance connected with my journalistic career. The approbation of Uncle Percy more than compensated me for the disapprobation of certain degenerate members of his family, one of whom, when I quoted Uncle Percy at her, replied that the poor darling doesn't know much about literature, and went on to crush me by telling me that Mr. Asquith didn't at all like the Academy. I assured her that I took this as a great tribute, but I doubt whether she believed that I was serious. I was quite serious. I have never sought or desired the countenance or the approbation of the Asquiths. If I had done so, there would not have been the slightest difficulty about obtaining them. When I had edited the Academy for about 9 months, my cousin, Lady Grey of Falardon, then Lady Tennant and afterwards Lady Glenconner, asked me to dinner to meet her brother-in-law, Mr. Asquith, the late Lord Oxford and Asquith, and she asked me to bring with me and introduce to him all the staff of the Academy, who were included in her dinner invitation. Mr. Asquith was at that time Prime Minister, and I violently disapproved of his conduct of the affairs of the nation, especially his education bill and his licensing bill, both of which I had a hand in destroying. I told my cousin that I did not care to meet Mr. Asquith, and the projected dinner party did not come off. All this, however, belongs to a much later period than that with which I've been dealing, and to which I must return in my next chapter. End of chapter 3.